This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Gestalt leaders.
The town with 7,300 eyes.
Hotheads.
And mutineers versus Magellan.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the bleep of the bridge console, the crunch of weird primary colored food, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive, but in the guise of an alien who is going to test us, welcome us into the gaming hut where beloved Patreon backer Darcy Castleman has a question and a conundrum for us to solve. Darcy says, I'm thinking of trying something different for my next Star Trek campaign, inspired by Ars Magica's troop play. The basic idea is having everybody build a bridge crew member and a lower decker, where the lowly ensigns are subordinate to some other player. But what if everybody could play the captain? Do you have any ideas on how to make a gestalt captain a cool character? Robin, what are your ideas on this?
Well, I have an obvious idea and an inobvious idea. So let's start with the obvious, as we always do on this here podcast. So the thing that comes most immediately to mind is if it's a gestalt captain jointly played by all of the players should have a role in creating the captain. And you could do that by having a little questionnaire of what their different qualities are. And each member of the group could answer one question in the questionnaire, and you could go around, and everybody thereby has a stake in this character because they all jointly contributed to it. So the first question should be, you know, how old is the captain? Next one is what does the captain look like? What is the most famous incident in the captain's past? What is the captain's hobby? What is the thing that people complain about the captain, and sort of work them out that way and create a collective character. And so everybody has a joint stake in who they are, and then also a joint idea of how to play them.
That is one obvious answer. My obvious answer, since we're each doing our obvious answers first, is the captain is a Trill. And each player represents one of the Trill's past lives, and because of an ion storm or something in the past, the captain, unlike most Trill, is able to access the memories and personality of all their past lives instead of just the sort of memory of the worm that lives in the human head. It's got the memories and personalities and whatnot of all the humans. So it's actually an even better Trill. And that's why they have risen to the post of captain of a Federation starship. And everyone takes a past life, and one of them can be the one that, that knew Captain Kirk and was a rival to Captain Kirk, and one can be the one that was off with Captain Sulu exploring the Gamma Quadrant that we'd never even hear anything about, and another one can be a Trill who wasn't even in Starfleet and was off serving as a mercenary with the Klingons, and you just get to build all of those up until you have this fun composite character, and whenever a character is playing them, the assumption is that that their Trill personality is dominant, but they can use memories and skills from the other players with a little cooperation and help. And they can say, oh, Carla, remember your Kirk era captain? I'll bet he'd have something really useful to do right now. And Carla says, absolutely. And, you know, maybe it's even a modifier. It's plus two to inspiration, or it's plus two to starship combat, or it's just Carla gets to sort of share a little bit in how they play the captain together, rather than rotating the captain off, which is, I assume, what sort of Darcy's original vision was. But a Trill captain would be fun and weird, and also kind of explain why no one is playing, you know, Kirk or Picard or whoever the captain is sort of modeled on. I think that adds a nice meta level to the game.
My inobvious answer is that rather than establishing the character through joint creation at the beginning, through everybody getting together and creating a composite character, is that the captain is something of a cipher to begin with, and that the traits of the captain are established an episode at a time. And as the rest of the crew learns more about the captain, that those things then become parts of their traits. So the part of each scenario that you set up is designed to in some way reveal a facet of the character. And just as Picard started off seeming sort of stiff and distant, and his character arc over the course of the Next Generation TV series is that finally he becomes, you know, truly a peer with the other main members of the crew. And it's, you know, we last see them playing poker together, you know, he's become friends with them and learn to loosen up, which apparently is something that paralleled his actual relationship with the rest of the cast, Patrick Stewart's relationship, that you could have a similar arc here where the captain begins as somewhat distant, and either the decision that the player who's assigned to play him in the first session makes defines something about him and reveals something about his character. Or you could have a different mode of revelation each time there was a new scenario and someone else has taken their turn playing the captain, so that the next time around, the expert from Starfleet Science Academy who comes on board to, you know, test the meson radiance of a strange interstellar anomaly is the captain's ex-spouse. So you then find out about her past because, oh, here you're meeting her husband, and that reveals something about her. And so that you are both kind of players are contributing to the characterization, but also they are discovering stuff about the captain as you go along. And therefore the character begins to seem richer as they become more dimensioned and as more facts about them are revealed. And that's something that you could do for any sort of leader character in any sort of genre game where it makes sense to have one and to distribute the power. And so the same could be true of, you know, a fortress where the a knight from another country, it turns out to be the next heir and comes and moves in, and you are all discovering things about your lord, or, you know, the new robot from the Dimension X who's suddenly become head of the Justice League. You all discover things about the new leader of the Justice League as you go along. And that could be sort of a fun way to both have a character that you're exploring and learning more about, and also have your other characters that you have full control over.
And you can even take it mechanically where you write up the captain's sheet at the sort of baseline level. You know, no one is going to be a captain without such and such in, you know, starship combat, such and such in inspiration, such and such in whatever else. And then during the scenario, if they roll really well, then their stat goes up once, right? Maybe once per session or once per scenario, so that they, you know, they really nail it in the, you know, starship maneuvering. And suddenly it's like the first time Picard unleashes the Picard maneuver and everyone's like, oh my God, this is amazing. Our captain was apparently, a great tactician and served during the Dominion War or whatever, or the war with the Romulans, whatever your time frame is. And that then can help add, you know, not just personality, but also character history, because now you have to explain why there's suddenly a crack shot with a phaser or desperately hopeless at languages or whatever the role was that is sort of, you know, creating the character in play. And then once you've sort of, you know, established, you know, maybe one good and one bad, or just one good because it's the captain and you're all sharing them, the captain should be awesome. You just keep building that out. And eventually by the end of play, you have a character, you know, similar to Kirk, who is almost as good at, you know, figuring out what's wrong with the engine as Scotty, and almost as good at knowing history as Spock, and almost as good at everything as every other member of the crew. And it's not in this case because William Shatner is demanding all the good lines, but because he's the captain, or she's the captain, they're the captain, whoever they are. And you've rolled it such that they have this wonderful little Macedwan of characteristics that provide you the same sort of fun in discovering the character that you get when you're reading a Sherlock Holmes story. And Sherlock Holmes says, oh yes, of course I can bend iron pokers in half. Everyone could do that, can't they? Anyway, moving on. And your whole vision of this character changes from the sort of indolent lounger to a guy who'd be a pretty robust brawler.
Right. And I guess the other decision then is how central you want to make the captain to the campaign and to the scenario, right? Are they someone who you're playing them in the ready room and you give out the orders, and then the focus is mostly on these two other sets of characters, because this is a very populated group of characters on the we've got going here. And so you would want to, you know, stick with the everybody thinks up something about the captain, and then you play him when you need to, but he's just the one giving the orders. He's not the one executing things, as Right. Logically he would actually be if Starfleet was real. Or you can make him the, you know, or her the focus of each individual scenario. And that way they take a big part of it. And therefore the player's other character sort of fades into the background, right? So that if you have a mission that does not really require the doctor at all, the player who would normally be playing the doctor instead plays the captain, and the captain is the main focus and everybody else is sort of revolving around them. I think that kind of, there's the danger of making this too interesting in a way that gets rid of the whole central point of having a troop play captain, which is that nobody feels that they're being bossed around, at least not every single session. So you may want to make this less interesting, right? And so that the captain that you've spent all this time group creating doesn't steal all the focus from all the other characters that you want to be playing.
Well, the good thing about Star Trek is you have your planet stories and your ship stories. And on a planet story, as you say, the logical situation is that an away team goes and does stuff. And the away team, one assumes, is the regular player group, player character group. And the captain stays back. And maybe if the party, you know, the players can't decide on a way forward, you know, they can call back and get guidance from the captain. And then whoever's turn it is to be the captain that day makes the decision. And then you move forward that way. But the captain isn't present except when they're on the other end of a communicator and you need them for something. And then on the on-ship missions, as you suggest, a player who would normally play the, you know, the chief geologist gets to play the captain instead or whatever else. And you can swap it around that way. And then usually what you've got is the common foe of the weird space virus or the jerk from the Starfleet who's giving you dumb orders that everyone hates, the commissioner, whoever that guy is. And of course, if you've got a space virus, captain gets hit first. That, oh no, the captain is down. Also a bunch of red shirts in deck 7, but mostly the captain is down. Now we have to figure out what to do. I mean, the Tholian web is a classic Star Trek episode, which is literally centered on the captain being gone and they have to work out what's going on. In this starship, that might happen a little more often than it did in one where you've got Patrick Stewart making grumbling noises in his throat about being written out.
And on that note, before the gestalt captain of this podcast, who we've never introduced before, shows up and starts bossing us around, it's time for us to take a starship through this exciting stellar anomaly and or commercial message.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
It's time once more to get out the drafting board, to listen to the groovy new pens that these days make the blueprints, which are no longer blue or involve that sort of printing, because we're once again in the architecture hut. And this time around, we're going to look at a town in a little part of the world, Ken, that is of interest to you. But this town is of interest to everyone because it's a town with 7,300 eyes, an oddly specific number of eyes.
Dun, dun.
Ken, how can a town have eyes? And what town is it? And where is this town?
So many questions. And you, when you wrote this up, you gave me the link to the article to begin my little random walk through the data. And the article is a lovely travel article about the town of Sibiu in Transylvania. And the picture with the article shows zero eyes. So well done, Journée Mondiale.
Fortunately, there's many other photos of the houses
there's
in Sibiu.
Many other photos.
Shows why they are said to have eyes.
Yes. Sibiu is the former Hermannstadt, back when it was a German colony in Transylvania, also known as Zsebin in Hungarian, or Nagy Zsebin, meaning Big Sibiu. It's been nicknamed the city with eyes, or the city where houses don't sleep. I feel like the town with 7,300 eyes is a great giallo also. Just going to throw that out there.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, the specific is always more terrifying than the general.
But anyway, the king of Hungary and Croatia, Geza II, brings German colonists who are known as Saxons. They don't necessarily come from Saxony, but, you know, every German is a Saxon the way that every American is a Yankee, I guess. They're brought to Transylvania and founded a city. And the city began as Sieben, because, of course, the Hungarians were the ones naming it, but it rapidly became Hermannsdorf, a.k.a. Hermannstadt. And whether or not there was a guy named Hermann who was in the first row of colonists, or if it was just all Germans are named Hermann and they're all Saxons, whatever.
Yes, there's lots of like attempts to create legends around Hermann, but no actual recorded evidence of who he was.
Right. It becomes the capital of Transylvania in 1699 and stays that way as long as Transylvania is a thing of itself. And it's a majority German population until 1941. And then there's some ruction.
Yeah. Even today, it is considered to have German qualities and German traits are ascribed to it. So people hiring contractors or furniture makers will get people from Sibiu because of their German quality workmanship. So this is an identity that is not only continued into the town, but continued in the reputation of that other towns feel that it has even today.
Right. And the German population, it did not increase certainly after 1941, but after the first big dip, it stayed pretty constant until German reunification, when finally the deal was too good and also you could leave communist Romania. So most of the Germans left in the 90s is what happened. But I know what people are saying.
They left behind their tradition of quality workmanship.
They did. I know what people are saying. They're saying, we actually did not sign up for the demographics hut. We're looking for the architecture hut. Where are these darned eyes? And the answer is they're in the roofs of many, many buildings in Sibiu, especially in the old town. And they are what are called eyebrow dormers. And these would be semicircular or trapezoidal dormer windows, little windows stuck out of the roof. And the shingles sort of fold over them. The dormers don't have sides. They just have a shingle curve that flows over them, which looks kind of like eyelids. And when you see them, yes, it is immediately, oh, that's what they're talking about. Those are eyebrow dormers. If ever there was a good architectural term, that is it.
Right. And they have a bit of a cartoony effect, or even sometimes they look like it's the town of 7,300 side eyes. So they definitely make, even though a house will have like six of them, it still looks anthropomorphic, and it does make the houses look sapient.
Look cool. Mostly they're in the old town, but there's eyebrow dormers in many areas of Sibiu. And what their job actually is that they ventilate the attic. The ground around Sibiu is wet, and so storing stuff in the cellar is a great way to get it moldy. So if you don't got something you want to store, but you don't want it to get moldy, you put it in the attic. And if you put it in the attic, you have to have ventilation for it. And that's where the eyebrow dormer comes in. Everywhere I looked said confidently they originated in the 15th century. And nothing I found bore that out in the slightest. But on the Sibiu architectural page, many of the buildings with eyebrow dormers date to the 15th century. So were they built then? Were those eyebrows put in, you know, circa 1450, 1500, and then sort of laid fallow and then came back in style because a lot more of them were built in the 19th century? I don't know. But the town of Sibiu, obviously, like many European towns, went through some ruckus, but by and large, it's been relatively unsacked. The Turks and the Hungarians fought over it without managing to burn Sibiu down. And so it's plausible that some of these eyes could go back to the Renaissance. I don't rule it out necessarily.
Right. And if the town was not sacked, that would mean the town was vigilant and the houses warned the people. So
paying attention. E.M. Forster, beloved novelist, wrote a little travel piece about the eyes in 1932 for the Spectator called The Eyes of Sibiu, in which he posits that the Pied Piper's children emerged in Sibiu from Faerie, and that the eyes are somehow, he doesn't go into details, are somehow connected to that. I think he was mostly just surprised to find blonde Germans in Romania, but that's E.M. Forster for you. He didn't listen to the beginning of the hut.
Yeah, I wish he connected a few more of the dots there.
But, you know, he had a strict word count. He had to go on, do some other stuff. But the eyes do become a symbol of anti-corruption protests against the ruling Social Democrats in Romania in 2017. And people would put the eyes on posters and stand outside the Social Democrat Party office. And the posters would say, "We see you from Sibiu." And that was a pun both in Romanian and English. And then it sort of became the national symbol of the protests was these fun eyebrow dormers. The town of Sibiu has some other fun features about it, including the Bridge of Lies. In 1859, they replaced the old wooden bridge with a stone bridge. And I think that was because the wooden bridge famously shook if a liar crossed it and would sometimes throw them off the bridge. It was so mad. And so obviously you got to have business getting done.
Right.
And so you can't have the bridge killing people.
Yeah. If you're a politician, the first thing you have replaced is the bridge you can't walk across.
Right. And so it's kind of surprising it took them until 1859 to do it, frankly. But if you go to the pictures of the Bridge of Lies, you can definitely see lots of roof eyes looking at it and making sure, kind of, and that's probably why they're side-eyeing people, is because now they can just cross that bridge without anything.
Right. Well, the houses are thinking, if anybody can just change infrastructure without their permission, they might be next. That probably upset them quite a bit.
The eyes look concerned. Vlad the Impaler's son, Mihnea the First, aka Mihnea the Bad, he's assassinated in Sibiu.
You've got to be bad if you're Vlad Tepish's son and that's your nickname, but they have to point it out. And
that's your nickname. Yep. Anyway, he's assassinated in Sibiu in 1510, basically either in the cathedral or as he's just leaving the cathedral. Either way, he's buried in the cathedral now. And in 1553, they built a spade-shaped, like an ace of spades-shaped bastion for the city called the Haller Bastion. It was named after the mayor of that time, Haller. His house, by the way, six eyes in it. And the Haller Bastion is known as the Gate of Corpses. And they say that's because they took plague victims out of that gate during the plague. Who can say why it's actually the Gate of Corpses? But there we are. Eyebrow dormers are not exclusive to Sibiu. They do appear elsewhere in Romania. Brasov is one place that has them, but you can also find them in Geneva. And beginning in the 1880s and 1890s, you can see them in America when a variant of the Queen Anne style, which came in the 1860s, was being built out across the northern part of America called the shingle style. And many of the shingle style houses, because they had fun ornamental shingles, also put eyebrow dormers in. So you can see them in, for example, upstate New York in houses built right before the turn of the century. So the eyes spread, Robin. They might be looking anywhere.
Now, I tried to find other sources of weirdness associated with Sibiu, and the closest I came was just a few months ago in September, according to someone on TikTok. There were some UFO sightings there. Now, that might have something to do with something, or it might just be that our own gray alien...
TikTok is basically a peer-reviewed journal at this point.
Our own gray alien, who, of course, does not fully obey the laws of time as we understand them, may have heard this segment and then gone back to September to check out Sibiu.
Right.
So, to my mind, the compelling mystery remains the founder of the city, Hermann, of whom mysteriously little is known. You would expect... You know, there'd be something on this guy other than just a bunch of made up legends. And so I was able to source some more information, by which I mean I'm making this up. And if they're Saxons coming to Transylvania, they could well be coming from Saxony, or they could be coming from Lower Saxony. And one of the towns in Lower Saxony, of course, is Munster. Not the big Munster, not the big city you've heard of, but there's another town there called Munster.
That famous Munster.
Yeah. And this would also explain why the eyes later moved to America, just like a descendant of the original Hermann, who founded Hermannsdorf and later graduated into being Hermannstadt. Noted German-American Hermann Munster, presumably, descends from this line, and the magic associated with him and his family as a supernatural being presumably permeates the town even so. So this would be the ancestral seat of Munster Munsters. Family, not in Munster, Lower Saxony, because I understand, and again, I'm making this up, they were driven out. They had to leave very quickly, and that's why.
Well, the people of Munster and Lower Saxony were famously intolerant of Hermann and his ilk and or kin. I believe torches and pitchforks may have been involved. So obviously a problem.
Right.
So the notion, I mean, I guess this would fit with Transylvania being the place where all of your Munsters and Munster kin tend to collect up. I think that that's as good an explanation as any, and I mean that exactly what I said, but I feel like the eyes themselves, because the other thing about Sibiu is that according to Bram Stoker, somewhere near it at Lake Hermannstadt, there is no such lake, there is the Scholomance, the school for wizards run by Satan and stocked by the Soleimani, the wonder-working traveling wizards of Romanian lore, and they live somewhere around Sibiu. Now, I don't think they live in Sibiu because, you know, they've got to be up in a crag somewhere. That's wizard rules.
And they don't want to be watched. The eyes may be like a countermeasure, right?
So the eyes absolutely could be a countermeasure against magic, you know, wizard warding eyes, or the wizards could keep a town place And then their town place would, of course, be sentient like any other wizard possession. And then they would have eyes. And so I think either one is possible. And maybe some of them are wizard houses that are sentient, and others are places that good German craftsmen, possibly from Munster, may have built wizard warding eyes into the other houses. And so maybe the trapezoidal ones are the wizard wards, and the curved ones are the wizard eyes, or vice versa. And figuring out which shape of the dormer window will kill you magically, it sounds like an excellent thing for player characters to be doing, crawling over the roofs in Transylvania while possibly dodging other stuff that's crawling over the roofs in Transylvania, which might be Munsters, or it might be Vlad Tepes's son, who is, I believe, probably still pretty bad despite being buried in holy ground.
So this would be something that if your Knights Black Agents characters decide that they have to go to Sibiu, what would they be trying to find out there?
Well, they'd be looking for the Scholomance. We have Sibiu appears in the Dracula dossier. It's sort of the closest big city to, and it's not that big a city, it's about the size of Savannah. The closest big city to the Scholomance. So if they're on the trail of the Scholomance where Dracula studied, and they want to get, you know, his textbook, The Green Dragon, or one of the other works of magic that he used, then they would be in Sibiu investigating that and looking for the Scholomance. And maybe the Scholomance is going to help them against Dracula, and maybe the Scholomance already works for Dracula and they've made themselves even more trouble. Or in a non-Dracula dossier campaign, it's still in Transylvania, people. There's still going to be vampires somewhere. Vlad Tepes's frickin' son is there. I feel like I hardly have to draw them a picture at this point.
Right. So since people don't need a picture, it's time for us to head out of this segment and into another hut and or segment. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast's eyes focused by joining beloved Patreon backers
Michael Curtis,
Mike Merles,
Ollie Toivonen,
Peter Williamson,
and Chris McLaren.
The laughing and crying masks on the wall, the Punch and Judy whacking each other in a box, the casting call of attractive Canadians tell us that we're once more in that hut right near the theater, the stock character hut. And today we're looking at another stock character that might be your players as opposed to an NPC. But if it's not, you can always add an NPC of this sort. This would be the Hothead. Robin, you have brought us the Hothead, so why don't you describe him?
Right, so the Hothead, unlike some of the other stock characters we've talked about, is someone who's can fill various roles in the narrative, but whether they are the foil, a character who is trying to push the main character or a main character toward anger and action, or the antagonist, the character that the protagonist are in conflict with, or in this case, even the protagonist, and their dramatic pulls in that case will be between anger and impulse or reason and calm. So this is a character who makes stories happen, and the way they make stories happen is by taking rash, angry action, and this is why you find them in all sorts of stories and why it is useful to put them in your stories as a GM or to, within limits, make them, as you suggest, your character as in a role-playing game. So, for example, in Page Turners, the epic six-part game at the end, Inheritance, which is about a group of robots who wind up attempting to recreate and perpetuate human society. This is a scenario that makes big jumps in time and follows a historical saga. So the characters cycle in and out. So in book one, when there are still humans and the humans are aboard a ship that the robots are piloting, there is definitely a hot-headed character to push the action along and make things happen. His name is Palmer Aston, and he's the demanding human leader of the group of humans aboard who represent sort of the elitist element. And so that's a character that the GM can use to sort of poke the action along and create pressure and keep things moving. Much later, when there are no humans left, the robot Bob Smith shows up. He's a militant android. He can either be, depending on the situation that you've gotten to by that point, he can be the foil driving, again, the character to recommending a harsher, tougher action against another faction, or can be the leader of a rival faction. So the hothead can switch roles in that case. There's also an overzealous hothead who's your ally, but goes too hard at it. Her name is Sophia Hernandez, another robot, of course. And she causes trouble for you by doing what she thinks that you really want her to do if you were actually doing the things that involve taking her advice. And then, again, this recurs later on in book six in the later future of this civilization. There's yet another hothead character, Seacon Sanderson, the threat-conscious defense minister. And again, he can, depending on what's happening in the story, he can either be the foil or the antagonist. This is a character type, though, that goes way, way back all the way to some of the first narrative ever, right? Because Ken, Achilles is a hothead.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Iliad is about the anger of Achilles and how he throws tantrums and storms around. And when the Trojans kill Patroclus, he goes off on a tear and kills Hector in a duel. And then he desecrates his body, making it impossible to come to any sort of agreement. It's all about Achilles being this quick to anger, mercurial force who is also, of course, completely deadly in combat. And that is often, you'll see that connected, especially with hotheads when they're the protagonist, is that they've got a fuse and when it's lit, watch out, as opposed to they get themselves into hilarious problems, which is the other kind of hothead. And you see that with a character in Commedia dell'arte called Il Capitano, who are quick to anger, but can't back it up. But that's not quite the hothead as we understand him now. In Arthur, the classic hothead is Sir Agravaine, who is always trying to start trouble and pick fights. And because the round table is sort of not about that, he comes to resent the round table and he tattles on Guinevere is sort of his big role. So he's a hothead who is both a fighty hothead and a troublemaking hothead. Tybalt is, of course, your classic Shakespearean hothead antagonist in that he is a deadly fighter and also quick to anger. And his quick anger is what causes the other half of the problems in the story. Right,
but in Romeo and Juliet, he's the instigating factor who makes trouble for people who, they want to have a love story. They don't want to have all this killing and dying.
Exactly.
Also in Shakespeare, Othello, of course, is an protagonist hothead. And often when you have the protagonist hothead, there will also then be a instigator or manipulator who acts as a foil to them and drives them toward their reckless or hot-headed side. And so, of course, there's no story in Othello without Iago, or there's less going on in Macbeth without Lady Macbeth to push Macbeth toward that. While we're speaking of kings, let's just step back to go ancient just a little bit. Oedipus is a hothead in his backstory, and you do not see the consequences of that until much later in the action of Oedipus Rex. And so, in a way, his past self is the instigator, and his current self is the one who's forced to find out what happens when his old self messes around.
And then in the dime novels, you would always have the young gunfighter who would be the hothead, you know, usually nicknamed the Kid. And he's eager to draw down on whoever the reigning top gun is. And the story of, you know, our sort of protagonist is the reigning top gun, and a kid is always trying to start trouble with him, and he has to shoot him, and he feels bad about it. And they sort of twist that around with the kid in Unforgiven, who keeps yelling at Clint Eastwood, "Why aren't you murdering everybody?" And Clint Eastwood says, "Give it time, but it's not as easy as it looks." And then he makes it look super easy because it's Clint Eastwood and it's Unforgiven. But that character is a absolute, you know, solid piece of, you know, the American Western, even though because they're sort of an unappealing character, you don't see them very often as the main character. You see them usually as in a movie where you've got a gunman protagonist. He will have a friend who is the hothead who gets him into trouble, sort of a Benvolio type figure, as opposed to being the hothead himself. That's less common because it's usually a foil character in the original dime novels that all these come from. But when we're talking film hotheads, we have to bring up the hottest of possible heads, Joe Pesci, Robin. And you mentioned his character in Goodfellas, his character in Casino. Basically, in everything up until The Irishman, Joe Pesci is the greatest hothead that ever hotheaded, as far as I think film fans are concerned.
Yes, he's a threat to his own group, not just because he can't control his temper, but that might even mean that they're scared of him too. Those characters, Tommy DeVito and Nicky Santoro, are sort of the most obvious examples of the hothead character who drives the story. And by that, I mean, spirals the lead character into increasing disaster. Another absolutely classic example, of course, is James Caan as Sonny Corleone in The Godfather. He exists as a foil to Michael. Michael is the cool-headed one, and he's the hothead. And I assume everybody's seen The Godfather. You know what happens to hotheads in The Godfather. Johnny Boy, played by Robert De Niro in Mean Streets, is also very much part of that. The hothead can sort of, as Johnny Boy does, kind of allude into someone who's not necessarily always angry, but just sort of reckless. And mm-hmm. We could call the loose cannon character a different stock character, but since the function is so similar, and often the reason for them being a loose cannon is that they're angry or resentful, I think it's not worth doing another loose cannon segment. But their role is always the same, which is to introduce chaos that the protagonist has to deal with. And that's what makes the story happen. In The Maltese Falcon, Wilmer, played by Alicia Cook Jr., is a classic hothead. He's the young punk who's easily goaded by Bogart as Sam Spade and therefore made the fool. He winds up being the fall guy, the patsy. And it's fun to see him outwitted. So that's an interesting example of sort of a minor antagonist who we enjoy seeing get theirs. You've got a couple more Western examples.
Yeah, Chico, played by Horst Buchholz in The Magnificent Seven, is the classic hothead. And he's the guy, just like in the dime novels, who hasn't learned that killing means killing. He's just eager to take it to guns and defend the village against the bandits. And the other gunfighters, to one or another extent, are against this approach. And Chico, learning the meaning of responsibility, sacrifice, and finally giving up the gun, is the actual story arc. He becomes the hero of Magnificent Seven, and he's the one with the story arc. And the iconic characters, having watched a dramatic hero happen, can then leave and go on to the sequel. That's what happens to Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen. Marty McFly becomes a hothead. They add that to his character in Back to the Future Part 2 because they apparently decided they needed a way to make the story happen. Maybe, you know, fixing his backstory means he's added a new disadvantage. He You know, he's lost poverty, but now he's gained hotheadedness. And so suddenly in Back to the Future 2, the way to get Marty McFly to do something is to call him a chicken. And that creates any number of implausible circumstances. But it's weird to see that added to the sort of character who was the everyman, the sort of level-headed, are you sure about this, Doc guy? Now he's a hothead, which is wild. And then you have some more classic hotheads from action cinema, I believe, coming up.
Right. So Heat, the character Wayne Grow, who's not any of the main characters you're thinking of, is played by an actor named Kevin Gage. And his whole role in the story is to create all the chaos that is required to make everything else happen. He's the one who kills the security guard for no reason during the heist. The movie Hell or High Water has a couple of brothers involved in bank robberies. One is level-headed and the other is Tanner Howard, played by Ben Foster. He's gets a lot of screen time. And I think if you're looking for sort of an recent archetypal hothead, he's a great example of that. And he's another one who's sort of more on the reckless side and less necessarily on the angry side. For nerd culture purposes, we can't not mention Jane Cobb, played by Alan Baldwin in Firefly.
Adam Baldwin.
And he sort of goes back and forth between the hothead archetype and also the jarhead archetype, the needlessly aggressive soldier, which also has its roots in, goes all the way back to Roman theater. But he's very much in that mold and I think also resembles a lot of player characters who are militating for let's stop planning and just have the next fight, please.
Mm-hmm. And our modern iconography of hotheads includes Daffy Duck, who is, of course, the hot-headed one compared to Bugs Bunny's cool, conniving nature. Daffy Duck is the one that flies off the handle at all times. Johnny Storm, his name literally indicates that he's a hothead. He sets himself on fire. He's the Human Torch. To a lesser extent, other Marvel characters often behave in a hot-headed fashion. Namor is often very mad at the surface world. And the Hulk, of course, is a case study in what happens when your hot-headedness gets out of control. Miss Piggy, the rare romantic hothead, in which she is both the object of desire, the femme fatale, but also the hothead. And that's a wild combo that perhaps only an actress of the caliber of Miss Piggy can pull off. And then we have some tradition, and I think this is sort of going to blend into maybe another icon, but you have the sort of hot-headed hero whose poles, as you say, are between, you know, action and reason. And we, of course, being fans of action, want to see them fall to their action side. And with a character like Maverick, Tom Cruise's character in Top Gun and in Top Gun Maverick, we see that, you know, redeemed and justified. It's like, yes, we needed to be active, not those old stuffed shirts in the Navy. Good for you, Tom Cruise. And you see some of that in, for example, Captain Kirk or Indiana Jones, where we always want to see them, you know, go after something, possibly without having a plan, and trust to their own indestructibility to come through it. Captain Kirk, being a serial character, plays to those poles more often because often he famously says, you know what, we're not going to have a fight. We're not going to entertain these aliens for no reason. Just as often as he says, well, time to start wailing on people, and moves in. So your heroic hothead often is forced by the constraints of story or drama to stop being a hothead just when you hoped everything would get really cool. But again, I think that Captain Kirk is sort of on the heroic hothead edge up there with Maverick.
Right. In the cop film, speaking of Mavericks, Maverick cops, of course, are all over cinema, and you see a transformation from won't play by the book cop, who is more of sort of a death dealer, a vengeance seeker, or an implacable source of vengeance. And then in Lethal Weapon with Riggs, you get the character who is explicitly a hothead and reckless, in addition to not following a proper procedure or the technicalities of the law. And of course, after that, there are many other examples that follow in his footsteps. So
Russell Crowe's Bud White in L.A. Confidential may be the classic example of that.
Yes, where the reality of police corruption is folded into a police procedural. At the gaming table, as we've already suggested, in a drama game like Hill Folk or like Page Turners, having a GMC, a Game Master character, who is a hothead and is in position to make things happen, that can shake up the players when they've achieved too much harmony, and you need to change the situation. Well, a character can have that happen. For a more typical game group with a bunch of player characters doing something procedural, there's always somebody in the group who's already plays the hothead or the reckless character, and that can be a source of fun when you are stopping to think about how the other players are going to respond to this, or a source of frustration if you are just using that as an excuse to short circuit what everybody else wants to do and instead do the fighting and trouble that you want to do. And so if you are the hothead, if you're playing a hothead, a thing to do is to think about, when will everyone else enjoy my doing this? And when will it annoy the goodness out of them?
And just like Captain Kirk, you have to decide, is it time for a fight scene or is it time to behave like a spacefaring race of pacifists to impress a bunch of glowing aliens? And now that we've impressed a bunch of glowing Patreon backers and other listeners with our discourse on the hothead, I believe we have to turn to the side of rationality and sit quietly and listen to a commercial.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The whirring of time gears and the clacking of chronotons tell us that we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that his superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. But sometimes they're not sure, Ken, whether they want you to intervene in the time stream or to prevent other people from intervening. And that's the case here because they're just curious. They're just asking questions at Time Incorporated. They want to know how the timeline would change if Ferdinand Magellan fails to suppress the 1520 Port St. Julian Mutiny. So I guess your dossier begins with finding out who Magellan is.
Yeah, to begin with, although he sails for Spain on his most famous voyage, he is Portuguese, and this is going to cause him trouble, possibly mutinous trouble, later on. But he is born Fernão Magalhães in 1480-ish. His family is minor nobility, like they run a town. He enters the naval service when he's 15 or so in 1495. By 1505, he is joining a armada sent to establish Portuguese India. He serves in several naval battles, including the Battle of Diu, which breaks the Ottoman power in the Indian Ocean. In 1409, he is on a mission to Malacca, and apparently a fairly trusted member of that mission. His part of his job is to go on shore and dicker with the Raja of Malacca. And when he finds out that the Raja is about to slaughter all the Portuguese, he manages to get out of that situation and warn the fleet just in time. Then, perhaps a predictable sequel, in 1511, he serves in the Portuguese armada that is sent to conquer Malacca and teach the Raja to stop doing that. And he does. In 1513, he is conquering a whole different city, Azamor in Morocco. Here he's wounded in the leg, and between having sort of got up the nose of the King of Portugal and accusations of having illegally traded with the Moors, he is cashiered. His career is over in the Portuguese Navy. So in 1517, he leaves Portugal for Spain and marries the daughter of a fellow expat in Seville. So it's still Portuguese, but it's Portuguese in Spain. He had a plan, even before he left Portugal, to get to the Spice Islands, the Moluccas, by sailing west instead of east. And when he tried to sell it to King Manuel of Portugal, King Manuel quite reasonably said, but don't we control the route to the east? Why would we want a new route? And Magellan had no good answer for that. But it turns out, you know, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade by saying to the King of Spain, Charles I, the future Charles V emperor, hey, you know who controls the routes to the east? Portugal. You know what I can get you? A route to the west.
If only he'd said to the Portuguese king, I'll protect the other part of your monopoly, because otherwise somebody's going to come around and do this plan on you.
Somebody's going to do exactly this. He had a cosmographer named Ruy Falero, who had a special map. And on this map, he showed that the Moluccas laid in what was Spanish territory, the Pope having divided the world between Portugal and Spain in 1494. You had to figure out where the line of the Treaty of Tordesillas came through the other side of the world. And Ruy Falero says, well, it comes west of the Moluccas, and you can trust me because I will make a lot of money if I'm right. And so he and Ruy, Magellan and Ruy, are raised to the rank of captain general and given 5 ships. He departs Spain in August of 1519. The Portuguese try to sabotage the mission. They try to intercept him at sea.
Like, wait, he's doing that plan we shot down.
Right. He's doing that thing that we knew was bad for us. Why? So anyway, he gets past the Portuguese Navy. Perhaps he is wise to their plan. And he has 5 ships and 270 men. Falero, meanwhile, has developed the Jim Jams, the Yips. He is reported as being basically increasingly mentally unstable. And also, he has done a horoscope. He's an astrologer as well as a cosmographer. And it predicted his death on the expedition. And so maybe the one caused the Jim Jams, who can say, but he's not on the trip. Magellan stops in the Canary Islands, and his brother-in-law says the Spaniards captain 3 of his 5 ships, are planning a mutiny, so, you know, eyes on a swivel. And indeed, in October, the next month, Juan de Cartagena, the captain of the San Antonio, who, by the way, is commissioned directly from Charles I and reports directly to him, not to Magellan, refuses to follow orders. And Magellan accuses him of mutiny and relieves him of command. And he's backed up by the other ships and the other captains, so it sticks. By
so showing November, him a picture of the org chart didn't persuade him at all.
Not at all, because he had a sword. In November of 1519, they arrive in Brazil. They sail down the coastline to modern Rio de Janeiro. They reprovision. They think, surely by now, South America is done. We should be able to turn any minute now. And they have a very sad moment when they sail into the Rio de la Plata and say, look, I told you it would turn. And then they hit fresh water and realize they've just been sailing into an enormous river, and they feel terrible about it.
South America is very long.
Right. It turns out.
It goes a long way.
And this is, maybe why you wanted to have a map maker along. They do have a map maker, but not one as cool as Ruy Falero, and B, why the Spanish captains start thinking maybe this guy doesn't know what he's doing, because surely he would have known if South America was this damn long. So on March 31st, they put into Port San Julian, which is a random harbor in Patagonia, and they're in the Southern Hemisphere, so it's autumn, and so they're going to lie up until spring.
Right, and we have to pause the mutiny for a literary footnote.
Okay.
So Magellan has a chronicler, Antonio Pigafetta, and while they're in Patagonia, he learns and writes about the beliefs of the Tehuelche people, who are no longer extant culture, and he learns about their god Setebos. And the way he learns this, of course, is a very Age of Exploration thing, which is that Magellan's crew capture a couple of them, slap them in irons, torture them, and they cry out to Setebos for help, their god, who, of course, the Spanish and Portuguese go, oh, that's clearly a demon that they're seeking help from. But at any rate, Setebos becomes a literary reference because Pigafetta's chronicle is republished and translated and winds up in different languages. And so Setebos is referred to by Shakespeare in The Tempest and continues as a literary reference, which is the Tehuelche people do not continue, but occasionally you still see references to Setebos. And there's a lot of subsequent speculation about this mythological being. Is it a human? Is it a tiger and a toad at the same time? Is it extraterrestrial? So surprising little bits of cultural resonance come out of the definitely skeezy activity of Magellan and his crew.
Well, it is not the mistreatment of the Tehuelche that leads Cartagena and the other 2 Spanish captains to mutiny. It is their continuing anger at being led endlessly down South America by a Portuguese guy. And so Cartagena and the two other Spanish captains, Quesada and Mendoza, seize the San Antonio, the Concepcion, and the Victoria. And that's on April 1st. This is basically an Easter rebellion. And Magellan immediately takes action. He's captured Victoria's longboat, and he fills it full of his Marines and dresses them in the uniforms of the Victoria's sailors and sends it back. And he has one of his staff on board who pretends that he's carrying a message to Mendoza. And I guess he is, in a way, carrying a message to Mendoza, because when he's led into Mendoza's cabin, he stabs him in the throat, the message being, this is Magellan talking. And then the Marines, of course, have gotten on board the Victoria, and they seize it from the mutineers, and that's the end of the mutiny on the Victoria. Meanwhile, the Concepcion has got loyal sailors to Magellan, and so they just cut the cables of the Concepcion, so it drifts into Magellan's flagship, the Trinidad. Magellan easily recaptures it. He then trains all of his guns on the San Antonio, and Cartagena surrenders it. There is a mutiny trial that lasts 5 days. On the 7th, Quesada is beheaded, and Cartagena, who has family connections that Magellan doesn't want to anger, he's marooned. He's just put in a small boat and sent to an island off Patagonia and never heard from again.
Right, because technically he's the one who's answering to the king, not to Magellan. So
right, exactly. And the other 40 mutineers are sentenced to hard labor, which basically amounts to careening the ships and scraping all the barnacles off of
them. Get back on the boats. Yeah,
so
do the hard labor you're already doing as
you're already
sailors in the 16th century.
Even in careening a galleon, there has to have been a worst job, and I'll bet that's what those guys got. So Magellan is still sending scout ships south, and one of the scout ships is the Santiago, which wrecks itself in the next harbor south, Santa Cruz. Magellan, in July, reports that he's encountered giants in Patagonia. Are these the Tehuelche? Are these other giants? We don't know. Is it Setebos coming to find out what's going on? Who can say?
Right. They do mention in the previous account, one of the priests dancing to Setebos is gigantic. So it could well right. be the Tehuelche.
Right. So by August, they've moved south to Santa Cruz, which is a better harbor than St. Julian. By October, the weather is good enough that the fleet starts going south again. Eventually, after a great deal more Patagonia, they discover the Strait of Magellan, and the ships are now separated in the strait, and the San Antonio, which can't find Magellan, turns back to Spain. They're like, Magellan must be lost. We have to go back. It's commanded by Magellan's cousin, so he's not betraying him. He legitimately thinks he's lost, but the crew, of course, mutinies on the voyage and deposes him. And when they get back, they say, oh, Magellan is awful. He made us eat human flesh and he caused trouble and he tortured rich people who shouldn't be tortured. And you don't even want to know what he did to Cartagena, your buddy, King Charles. And so Magellan's family is, you know, basically cut off and badly treated and everything goes wrong. But Magellan doesn't know this because now it's November and his three ships have entered the Pacific. And he names it the Pacific because when he sails out into it, it's a very quiet ocean. And he says, how long can this ocean last? According to this cool map that deliberately moves Malacca, I've only got maybe a week of sailing. And rather than that, he has a whole lot of sailing because it's not until March that the fleet arrives at Guam. And somehow Magellan has missed all of Polynesia and most of Micronesia on his way to Guam. So the situation is pretty terrible. He does not have scurvy, as it happens. He's been eating preserved quinces, you'll be happy to know. But everyone else has scurvy, because there's only so many quinces. Guam being very inhospitable, the natives steal everything that's not nailed down and much of what is. They get out of Guam and they get to the Philippines. They land at Cebu, which is one of the Philippine islands. And Magellan starts converting everyone to Christianity, because that's your job. You meet foreigners, you convert them. And the Cebuanese are like, great, we love being Christians. By the way, what about those jerks on Mactan? Are you going to convert them? They're awful. And Magellan says, well, let me show you what superior Spanish technology can do for you. And he takes 47 guys to invade Mactan, Cortez style, and teach them a lesson. The trouble is the Mactanese bring 1,500 guys and they kill Magellan. And this is a battle on April 27th. And at that point, the Cebuanese say, oh, the Spanish can't protect us. And they massacre every Spaniard they can get to on May 1st. The fleet escapes. Elsewhere in the Philippines, they burned the Concepcion, which by now is rotten with worms. The Victoria and the Trinidad make it to the Moluccas. They buy tons of cloves. It turns out Moluccas are on the Portuguese side. There's already Portuguese ships there. And the Victoria and Trinidad split up. The Trinidad is recaptured by the Portuguese, rather captured by the Portuguese. But the Victoria successfully makes it back to Seville, the sole surviving ship with 18 surviving sailors, the first people ever to travel around the world.
I have to say, in grade school, when I was given the history of this, they left out all of the exciting murder and killing and bloody-handedness. I did not get the exciting version of Magellan.
How did you do Magellan without the murder? Anyway, you'll be glad to know the voyage turned a profit for the King of Spain. He made money on the deal because that's how much tons of cloves were worth. But they tried to do it again in 1524, and it didn't take. The ship, again, got jammed up in the Philippines, wasn't able to get through the Portuguese Navy, and that was the last time that anyone sailed around the world until Sir Francis Drake did it in 1580, and that was Magellan.
So what happens to the timeline where Magellan gets taken out earlier in the mutiny in April of 1520.
If he is taken out in the San Julian mutiny, the ships go back to Spain and say, well, turns out there's no way around South America. It was a lie. So there is a slight lag, obviously, in Pacific knowledge and map making. Drake maybe becomes the first person to circumnavigate. Maybe another Spanish ship eventually does, just going from, you know, the Caribbean to Peru. But the big difference is that it's Magellan is the reason that the Spanish decide they want to conquer the Philippines. They've got the record that says the Cebuanese initially embraced Christianity. They've got the record that says that it's not a very populated bunch of islands and they all hate each other, so that it's an easy divide and conquer move. And also it's convenient to these tons of cloves in the Moluccas, and surely we can take them away from the Portuguese if once we can get a foothold in the Philippines. So if the Philippines stay independent and disorganized, maybe they become Portuguese, but certainly they become Dutch. The Dutch are already sailing into the Indian Ocean in the 1500s. By 1600, they are getting ready to take over, you know, Taiwan, much less the Philippines. And the Dutch are past masters of this sort of divide and conquer treatment, which is how they conquer the entire East Indies. So the Philippines is a lanyap for them. If the Dutch conquered the Philippines in 1600, then it probably falls to the hated British in 1780 or 1805. Either of the times the British, you know, got to fight people allied with the Dutch and take the Dutch's solid gold goodies off them. But if the Philippines remain disorganized as long as that, there is a possibility of a large Chinese city state on Luzon. There was already, you know, 30,000 Chinese in Manila in the mid-16th, so you possibly have like an early Singapore set up there. So it's possible that the Philippines, only parts of it are Dutch or British, that the, you know, Sulu archipelago stays Muslim caliphate. Mindanao is full of a bunch of competing Muslim states. So who can say? The Dutch not into crusading, unlike the Spanish and Portuguese. So there might have been like a second Brunei there, or the Sultan of Brunei might have taken it because he was expanding around then too. The biggest change that that creates is that there is now no Manila galleon, that there used to be a galleon full of silver that would sail from Peru to Manila and bring lots and lots of silver to trade with the Chinese. And if the Chinese don't get the Manila galleon, then their economy is very short of silver. The Manila galleon supplied about a third of the silver in circulation in China, maybe as much as half, depending on how you run the numbers. And so with no silver, they can't reform their taxation and kick the economic collapse down the road by three generations. So the Ming probably collapse early, which is not good. And also, no chili peppers in Chinese food until they get them from California in the 1860s. So Chinese food takes a dire turn, Robin, if you ask me. So maybe you've collapsed the Ming dynasty early. Maybe you've collapsed Sichuanese cooking early. And certainly, you have probably let the hated British have the Philippines, which means America doesn't get them.
So it's a real object lesson at a phase when the world is increasingly globalizing that a small incident involving guys with swords on ships can radically change everything from countries that they had no intention of changing the history of to even to cuisine.
Right.
So this makes the age of exploration look increasingly deadly and adventurous, and therefore a place that player characters could be making their way. Trad gamers don't love being stuck on ships, but I think a one-shot aboard the ship when the mutiny is happening, and then perhaps some sort of nerd-troping event, perhaps an appropriately vengeful...
Setebos and his army of giants.
Vengeful Setebos shows up. Perhaps you could be the group of Tehelche Avengers, making sure things go your way, and that could be an interesting twist on the Age of Exploration.
Or if you're doing a Time Watch game, you know, this is your moment to crash the Ming early and change Chinese history. Your last shot at permanently disunifying China, perhaps, is to do this. And so you're there in Patagonia encouraging the Tehuelche to, you know, maybe build fire arrows and shoot them at the Spanish ships and see what happens then.
Yeah, if you're a team of super tasters who hate spicy food, this is your chance to get revenge on history.
Exactly, right.
Well, we love spicy food. We love spicy podcasts. We'll be back with another spicy podcast a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Stop this podcast from blowing its stack by joining such backers as...
Darren Dumay.
Lee Candelino.
Luke Steyer.
Chris McCarthy.
And Coleman Gonzalez.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.